All right.
Beautiful.
So welcome to the Presidio Bitcoin Jam with technical difficulties solved. Slam dunk 10 minutes late or so. It's all right.
Yeah, let's talk about our studio.
Okay.
So last week was our first in-person studio show, which was exciting.
Yep.
Because for two to three months, we've been doing like laptops, Riverside, impersonal.
Very DIY.
We were probably like working on other stuff during the show. Now we have no laptops in front of us.
And, well,
David has one, but he's the guy in charge. Yeah. So Max and I are like,
we're here,
we're present,
we're focused.
But yeah, I'm excited about this studio. I think we have to like level up our game because there's like we actually have it's like a pro studio.
You're saying so we can't just like bullshit with each other anymore?
We can no longer just be friends on a show.
This is a group chat.
Yeah. Anyway, excited for this new studio. Yeah. Last week was our first attempt. I think it was good. We noted a bunch of things to fix after the show.
We got some feedback that we were like some sort of JV Sports Center. What was
it? Yeah. That's pretty funny.
Someone on the spiral team said we were a low-budget sports center.
Okay, right.
So hopefully people notice that we're leveling up our game.
It's a very expensive low-budget
sports center. If this is low-budget, you don't want to know what we were doing before. So.
Yeah, compared to sitting on our laptops. Yeah, various remote locations.
Yeah.
But we have like way too much stuff. You know, the group chat's been flying. You know, the Google Doc, we're trying to organize everything's been flying. So I think we should just let it rip because, you know, sometimes I'll propose a few things and then like, you know, we'll get through the whole show and Steve will be like, wait, we didn't talk about this was like a must discuss. We didn't do it. So Steve, if there's anything must discuss,
I want to
open the floor right now to that.
Oh my gosh.
No pressure.
No pressure. Or you can think about the must discuss and I'll kick it off.
Yeah, what were our headline topics?
I don't know. Maybe Alex.
Bit bonds or something?
Bit bonds, yeah. Okay.
Let's start with bit bonds.
You want to start with bit bonds? So BPI, did you guys know about this Bitcoin Policy Institute thing that happened? It was kind of some DC event. I saw a bunch of clips. A friend was sending me around. There's this concept of bit bonds that was put on my radar. And I watched the video. You know, the high level here is there's, you know, kind of an idea that has been floated. This isn't like even to the level of proposal, but more like a thought experiment of what could you do to refinance the debt of the U.S. We've got all these treasury bills. They go to auction. They try to, you know, they try to get buyers. And I think China historically was a big buyer and is not doesn't have as much appetite for it these days. So they're trying to create a new type of bond called a bit bond that, you know, you could issue, say, $2 trillion of bit bonds and have $200 million of Bitcoin purchased as part of that. So that's kind of like the starting point. And then you issue these bonds and they pay 1% instead of what you might get in market is like about 4.3%. So you get 1% on the bonds. And then any Bitcoin price appreciation, the bondholder gets up to 4.5%.
Annualized.
Yeah. And then beyond that, you split 50-50 with the U.S. government, the Bitcoin appreciation. So
kind of like a VC carry.
Yeah, yeah. So like, hey, we got you like into Bitcoin.
One,
so
like a one, one N.
1%.
Or 150.
150.
Or no, it's not 50% carry. It's 50, it's like it's a 50-50 split.
Yeah. So it's 50-50 split. So, but the whole thing, I mean, like, I get why they're doing it, but I almost feel like it's sort of creating a vehicle for people who don't otherwise want to or can't get that kind of exposure. So it's almost like it's not for individuals. It's more like for institutions that need that kind of collateral and that format to do various swaps and whatever they're doing.
It is like a 150, right? The 20% carry for a VC, they get 20% of the upside.
Yeah.
So this is 50%.
Yeah.
This sounds to me like a MicroStrategy, like the same sales pitch MicroStrategy has, or I'm sorry, it's Strategy now.
Yeah. Right.
What they have for bond fund managers. Yeah. It seems like a similar
It is.
Pitch.
Yeah, I mean, I think, just to be clear, I'm certainly not an expert on this, but there's many different flavors I've heard proposed. I didn't watch this specifically, this Bitcoin Policy Institute talk. I mean, there are some that I've heard where, you know, if there's enough interest in this, you might actually get 0% interest on the
bond
itself. And I think that's just a function of demand in the market. In the case of Saylor, he's been able to give some of his bonds for 0% because of demand. And then I've heard others where it's like you get all, you know, the bondholder gets all the Bitcoin appreciation. This 50-50 split with the government seems pretty enticing for the government. But I think there's two interesting core concepts here. One is basically what you're saying, the genius innovation, if you can call it that, is just figuring out that there's giant pools of capital in the world with different mandates. And if there are giant pools of capital that say we can only buy sovereign bonds, that is bonds where we know we're going to be made whole on the face value of the bond because there's the U.S. government or whatever government issuing it, amazing. And so that's all they can buy.
And the face value of this bond is 1%, right?
Or the face value of the bond may be whatever the market rate is. So it could be 1%, that plus 1%, or so if it's $100 million, you get $100 million plus 1%. It could be 0% if there's enough demand for it. It could be 4%, whatever the market clearing rate is for that, I think. But the genius innovation then is like, okay, there's people at those funds, managers of this capital, that say, but wait a second, we want to buy Bitcoin. That thing has a 40% CAGR annualized. Like, that's going up a lot over time. We can't buy it. This is a way for us to kind of stealth, get exposure to Bitcoin with a lot less risk. So as Saylor always says, he's in the business. You know, people are like, oh, but you know, you're trading above NAV and this and that. It's right. No, actually, what he's in the business of doing is identifying pools of capital with mandates, carving up the risk of Bitcoin and the volatility of that such that he can sell them the upside with less downside to these different pools of capital. That's what these are.
I didn't read much about this. Is this a proposal for a private company like a strategy to create these, or the United States?
This is the U.S. government.
U.S. government.
Yeah. This is basically like, I think the U.S. government does not have big buyers in China, or maybe doesn't want big buyers in China, and probably China's smart to not necessarily want to own these bonds. You know, so I think there's sort of like a separation at a geopolitical level, but you still want somebody to buy the bonds. So you have to sort of find people to buy the bonds. So maybe Tether would be a big bond buyer, right? I guess would be like one of the types of things. But you could imagine other institutions that need to – they can only buy bonds to structure certain financial products, that those would be the buyers.
Yeah. What was the structure again? You said $2 billion bond. So
$2 trillion.
So 10% of it is –
10% of it is
Bitcoin.
Bitcoin. And the holders
– So if Bitcoin dies and goes to zero, then – 2%. You'd still – I mean, in the United States government, it doesn't –
right.
Die and go to zero.
Yeah. Which I think is like most people who aren't paying attention, that's like most of their assumption.
You'd
like,
take a 10% haircut. I mean, you might have earned some interest along the way too. But
well, it's a bigger than 10% haircut because you're getting 1% bond, and then where in the free market, or the open market, you might get 4.3% bond returns.
Yeah. That's the
interesting. So you're sort of foregoing that extra 3.3%. To get base level made
whole. You lose 10% of your principal and you had this opportunity cost on your yield.
And not necessarily that you lose the principal, right? Because you might, again, there's like different flavors of this. I've seen, you know, if it's $2 trillion worth of bonds, I've seen proposed only 1% that goes into Bitcoin, 10%, whatever. But like there's the flavors that I've seen, you still get the whole principal paid back. So if it's you buy $2 trillion worth of bonds and the U.S. government puts 10% in Bitcoin, it goes to 0.1% in Bitcoin, then they have to figure out how to make you whole on that. Which I guess you're assuming it's the government, so they can print the money, right?
Well, that's what's crazy, though. The people buying the bonds, I mean, I think if it's like an institution that has a mandate, then it makes sense. But if like an individual, if you're buying the bond, you're kind of saying, I put my, you know, this is backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government, which is kind of like what, you know, what these are all about. But like the government is sort of creating an arbitrage and they're saying, well, you know, we don't have much to give you, but Bitcoin's safe enough for you to hold. And so,
and this is the second point that I wanted to make. It's like all of these, it does seem like, as much as I want it to be the moment of payments and all of this stuff, it seems like we're at the moment of like securitization of Bitcoin and financial engineering. Like that is where all the money is being made right now. And like, but the weird, like, it's hard for us because we, I think, as people that are really sold on Bitcoin and believe this is going up, you know, long term, you almost have to play this weird mental gymnastics where you're like, okay, so I can, you know, kind of buy this weird instrument that I know it's only going to work because I know Bitcoin is going to work, or I'm quite confident I believe Bitcoin is going to work. But I have to play these mental gymnastics because if you really believe that it's going to continue to go up 40% CAGR, well, then the smart thing to do, of course, would be just to buy Bitcoin.
Yeah, why give 50% of the government?
But again, it's because large bond fund fund managers, they are constrained.
It's mandate. So I think it's almost like everybody's going to exploit every mandate of capital pooled to a mandate, and they're going to just like exploit it with somebody who's bullish on Bitcoin, somebody who understands Bitcoin, who manages, you know, that kind of capital.
And for better or for worse, I mean, I thought a lot about this from an investor perspective because I've heard rumblings now of a few other companies that are trying to figure out, both private companies and potentially public companies, you know, that are trying to figure out how do you basically arb the fact that there are large pools of capital with these weird mandates. I guess not weird mandates, but mandates that are, in theory, you know, are designed to protect people, but in reality just end up creating these weird pockets of arbitrage. And like, maybe the case is like you just have to exploit all these, you know, lots of countries issuing these bonds, lots of different kinds of bond funds that are able to access the Bitcoin exposure. And like Bitcoin will finally take off as payment once all these, you know, giant pools of capital are arbed. Maybe that takes 4 years, 5 years, 10 years, and it brings Bitcoin well over $1 million, and then it can start to play, you know, its role as the currency.
And I was having this conversation with a friend the other day who's like definitely a hardcore Bitcoiner, but he's also kind of like asking the question, like, is it just niche? Is it just, you know, for us, the small cypherpunky type people, or can it be mainstream? And I was like, I don't know that you're going to get the whole world to become cypherpunk as fast as you're going to get like people who optimize for financial products to do it. And it's like, I'd rather everybody convert to figure out cypherpunk ideals instead. But I don't know that that's realistic, that we can get more people interested in understanding and exposure to Bitcoin, at least exposure to the price, if not the ideals. I don't think we can get that unless you educate everybody around cypherpunk ideals. And I don't know that that's going to all happen overnight. So I feel like if this is almost like a marketing message that the U.S. government is just sort of like giving a stamp of approval for people who need that stamp of approval. Obviously, people who've been in it for years, we're not waiting for that stamp. But
and if I put on my idealist hat, as we've talked about many times in the show, the reason I got into Bitcoin, the reason I've started my funds is like I want to see this used as an actual currency. I want to see this enabling all kinds of new things. And I'm still very bullish on AI using Bitcoin and things that are, you know, new you can't get otherwise. But if I put on purely my like investor hat and just try and see reality clearly, like the best investments right now are going to be these companies that figure out how to slice and dice Bitcoin's risk return profile for the giant pools of capital. MicroStrategy has been the big winner so far, but it's not just going to be MicroStrategy. It's probably good private investment opportunities of, you know, people that understand how to securitize. And like the key insight is you need to figure out, you need to have at least some secret or connection to capital to understand they can only buy, there's people in there that want Bitcoin exposure. They have a mandate that they can only buy XYZ form of a financial instrument. And I need to be the guy to go and sell it to them. It is what it is.
And I think we're aware of at least one or two startups looking at the slicing, dicing for home equity.
Yep.
That's a great example.
HELOCs, and what's the other structure of a HELOC?
HEI?
Yeah, HEI.
Is that the home
better,
investment
the better version?
I think it's a home equity investment. I think a HELOC is just like cash to do whatever you want, more or less. You can go on vacation. I think a HEI is cash for the purpose of allocating to a different investment,
right?
I think.
But the general concept here is that, you know, there's a lot of people who have a lot of their net worth tied up in their home equity. And wouldn't it be great to extract some of that, especially if, you know, you might be in a position, you have $1 million home and maybe you have like $600,000 of equity in it, but you have no Bitcoin. But you believe in the thesis. You want exposure, but you really have no other liquidity to buy that Bitcoin. This would be a sort of, you know, nicely packaged service or product to allow you to do that.
Yeah, and you know the guy who gave the proposal at BPI, the one who I sent the clip around, the guy who gave that proposal is the guy who you may have seen. He was on like, I don't know, CNBC or something. His clip went around a few months ago where he was doing this, basically that idea you're talking about for commercial real estate.
And
they collateralized it and got debt with like
it was that same guy.
That was the guy. The guy who's doing this with commercial real estate. He has like the first example of this thing, I think in some commercial, you know, building in Philadelphia, I think. Right. So he's like out there beating the drum on that, which is, again, just like different exploits of understanding of the traditional financial system to get people just a little flavor of Bitcoin, right?
Totally. And oh, by the way, I mean, to your point there, I mean, again, as you, when you put on your investor hat, it's about even you may want something to be the outcome, but then you also just have to see reality clearly where it is. And you look at how much money is locked up in, for example, you know, I wouldn't even think in commercial, that's a great example, but residential. It's like there's a whole generation of baby boomers that I believe the meme is paid 5 raspberries or something for their home. Like, as they start realizing they're probably not the early adopters of Bitcoin, like, wait a second, this, like, magic. I like that meme when someone said, like, you know, boomers are trying to sell us their homes at, like, marked up at significant valuations. So we send them our magic internet money marked up at significant valuations. Like, that kind of seems like the next big trade in my mind.
Right. So we are not even, like, finance bros. We're tech bros.
Yeah.
But here we
spent the last. It's not why we got into this, but here we are.
We spent the last 15 minutes or whatever talking about finance topics. But let's switch it up and talk some tech topics. So as I mentioned last week, I've been vibe coding a little bit. I've been dabbling in it. And I would say I've been only moderately successful so far.
Are you kidding right now?
I'm not. At the moment, I'm not. I know last week I was.
What a waste of time, yeah.
Last week, during the show, I was vibe coding, yeah. but this week I'm not.
We never saw the result.
Yeah.
Well, that's part of what it is. Is like
ship it or it didn't
happen. When you're starting with this stuff, you have like configuration stuff and like, okay, where am I going to run the client and server and the local stuff and the port and like get it on like a, you know, a public, you know, how are you going to host it publicly? So there's just like stuff. So part of what I'm doing is playing with this. And I've got like 5 prototypes that I can run locally, but I haven't pushed anything out yet. And they're only prototype quality. None of them are stuff that I'd be like, oh, this is awesome. You should play with it. It's kind of like, oh, it's awesome that I got that far with doing so little. And I've spent hours on this, but not like 12 hours a day. All the YC kids, they're spending 12 hours a day, and I think 90% of the code is written by AI.
So I have a question there. So yeah. I've not dabbled as much as you, but I've dabbled a little bit, including with you. And it's my impression.
Oh, but we did it like years ago, right?
Yeah, but even recently.
Okay.
I dabbled a bit. And my limited experience, it matches yours, where I find it incredible what it's able to do, but it doesn't really fully deliver the results. So when I hear things like 90% of coding, it's going to be all done by AI in 6 months by, you know, whatever, all of Silicon Valley or all the Y Combinator companies, it still seems like a little bit farther off in the future. So what's the story there?
Well, maybe the 90% is kind of surprising, but then when you think about it, it's like, well, humans are really slow at figuring out code, typing code, copy-pasting from Stack Overflow, and these AIs just crank through so much. So if you just need a bunch of infrastructure set up, you do it, and it's going to add thousands of lines to your code base with like a single prompt. And so you're going to maybe write like dozens of lines of code to like stitch some things together or fix something, or maybe you'll reprompt. But there's very little, like, you just can't do much compared to what it can do as long as you can prompt it well.
There are different metrics to measure here.
Yeah.
Like, one would be, given a competent developer, are you able to reduce the time to market for something by 90%? Or, you know, similarly, like, it just takes them 90% less time. Another would be you open up a whole new market. 10 times mm-hmm. more people can produce results, and they weren't, you know, they're not skilled or trained as a developer. So they would be considered not a competent developer today.
Right.
But they're able to produce something that a competent developer today could. And that's like 10x or 100x. You know, either of those would be like monumental outcomes.
Right. And lines of code is never a good metric to use for developer productivity. So it's a little bit of like maybe it's a fake thing to even discuss at that level. But I know like a specific.
I'd say less lines of code actually would be a bigger.
Often advantage. Better, right? Everybody's just being Lisp.
or how about just like users for their software? Like if people are actually using it and getting some value out of it, that means it's working. Is it your sense? I mean, I haven't played like with Cursor in a little while, so you guys are probably both more recent than me. But I did get some like somewhat sophisticated stuff. I was actually trying to build like my own Nostra relays and stuff. And it got, let's say, 95% of the way there. I then, not being a competent developer, had to sit there and just bang my head against the keyboard at the last 5%. And then at that point, I was like, well, it kind of makes sense that this is all, the AI is still happening inside of an IDE or in a development environment, because you still do have to, like, you need to know what you're doing. So if you're competent, maybe, you know, 90% of the time is gone. You have to mess together. For me, it probably still took 4 hours just to figure out, why is this Python code not gluing well with this database and blah, blah, blah. Is it your sense that some of these kids in the YC batch that are doing this are just like non-technical and still shipping products people want? Or is it more they're the 10X engineer that, you know?
I think it's way more 10X today.
Got it.
Like maybe 6 months out or a year out. I mean, it'll enable a lot more non-technical people, maybe with domain expertise or like a lot more ideas to flourish.
Yeah.
But when I look at the trajectory of these things, like Steve, when we were doing the stuff on Replit, was that a year and a half ago or so? And we banged our head on this for, you know, an hour and got nowhere. And then we bounced out to, I think, create.xyz. And we kind of got like something that was satisfying in about 10 minutes. But the whole thing wasn't really up to what we wanted. Today, you can actually accomplish that thing there's like probably at least half a dozen services that I've used where you could build like, say, a simple tic-tac-toe game where you don't write a line of code and it actually works. Like, it's way better than it was a year and a half ago. And I don't expect we're slowing down. I expect we're speeding up. So
one idea that you've always posited is that in the future, you know, there's an opportunity for a company to be some kind of like repository where it's like lots of people put different ideas and you can mix and you can, yes, you can like vibe code with your agent, but then you can also mix and match different components, put them together and build like more complex software. What do you like, how do you actually envision that? Like what would you, let's say I wanted to come in as a noob and like look at all the different tic-tac-toe games that are out there.
Yeah.
What am I actually like copy pasting? What am I newly vibe coding? What am I actually gluing together?
So vibe coding is less copy paste and it's more prompt.
Okay.
Right. So you open up Cursor and you've got a little chat window, or you know, open up Replit Agent is actually a simpler way to deploy everything. It's a little less control, but like a lot simpler to get actually public on the web. But you just go into a chat session, just like you're using like ChatGPT or something, but you're typing things like, hey, I want to build an app that plays tic-tac-toe, and like deploy it. And it will do that. Like you can actually get the whole thing built from scratch by just giving it a very simple prompt like that.
Okay.
Now, if you want to do more things with it, you just kind of re-prompt and you say, actually, now add a leaderboard. Now add a timer. Now add a something, you know, you can kind of like iteratively develop, but you're not really doing a lot of copy pasting of code. You're really just like tweaking with additional prompts of what you want to do. So imagine that you have like three junior developers and you're just like dispatching tasks to them.
So what do you see as the like reusable component? Because I know you've always had this thesis that, you know, maybe there's a chance to take elements of the old tic-tac-toe game and remix it.
I'm going to interrupt real quick. Because we are a show where we want audience engagement.
Yeah,
we're
still
working on that.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm seeing a little bit of engagement
now. Oh, great.
And usually the engagement we want is like topics or feedback on what we're talking about. But in this case, let's get closer to the mic.
Yeah.
So,
especially our kind of
mics. Beautiful. Hopefully that's a little better.
Cool. Yeah. Proceed.
Awesome. So we were talking about kind of apps and how do you get reusability. I think a lot of this is going to be like a side effect of building useful things. I don't think we have the model, like MCP as a concept did not exist, what, 2 years ago?
Or 3 months, or I guess it did.
I think it existed 6 months ago, but wasn't like popular use. Now it's like in the zeitgeist, everybody's talking about MCP, everything, right? So like that is a nice kind of structured way to imagine the composability of ecosystem software better.
Yes.
I don't think we have like the atomic unit of like, I'm going to take the very best platonic ideal of a tic-tac-toe game and now add a leaderboard to it. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think we're at that level. I think it's just like chaos everywhere.
Right.
MCP is an example of a framework to think about structuring some of the interactions between things and componentizing things a little bit. But I think it's like just at the very beginning. I think the thing that I would find interesting is for a lot of very small, simple, kind of crazy experimental things to happen. And then we sort of learn, oh, we need a really good way to say like accept Lightning payments. And maybe it's an MCP thing or maybe it's something else. But I don't have a sense of like I've prompted to try to get a few Lightning things built and have so far been unsuccessful. And it actually looks like it's kind of doing the right thing. It's like I see the libraries it's including and it was suggesting LND and I was like, why not LDK? And I don't know.
Steve had a good conversation about that. That
was an interesting side.
Well, that's kind of a sidebar, but yeah. Like, why did it not? Do you have a sense why it was choosing LND versus LDK? Or,
I mean, you sent me the link, and then I interacted with the AI and just sort of bullet point by bullet point disputed it, and it's like, oh, you're right.
Yeah.
So after the show, I'm gonna like lie and make up stuff and see if it thinks I'm right.
You're still right.
And by the way, that was like why that was. Grok answering the question of why LND and not LDK, and separately the coding was being done by by Claude 3.7 Sonnet. So the coding tasks were being done by a different AI than the one that was answering those questions.
But the bigger point is like, whether LND or LDK is used, who really cares?
Yeah,
it's more like, why isn't there more energy around AI payments?
Yeah, and I feel like
in the Bitcoin space, and maybe the AI space as well.
And I feel like anybody who's working on Lightning is, I don't hear from enough people who are like working on something where they're trying to do Lightning and they have any idea that these AI coding tools exist even. Like, not that they don't have any idea, but like, I don't see a lot of experiments. I don't see people saying like, oh, look, you can actually take a simple Lightning payment just by prompting for a simple, you know, make a tic-tac-toe game where it costs, you know, 5 sats to play and, you know, and the winner gets the result. That seems like such a simple concept. And I would bet that AI could help anybody build that kind of thing very quickly. But I see people working in the very traditional way and sort of not there's not enough crossover, in my opinion. So it's like, how do we discover where those pockets of crossover are, or how do we encourage them to
There's a lot in what both you guys are saying. I think we could go on many, many different routes here. I will just say, on the subject of the Bitcoin community using AI and the AI community using, you know, payments of some form, potentially Bitcoin payments, I will say some of my founders that I work with are using AI a ton. And so, you know, just to give a shout out, obviously Jordy's focused on Lightning payments and any kind of payments for bots, which I think is very interesting. Christopher David just shipped a new version of Open Agents, which is kind of like Cursor in the cloud that, you know, potentially is going to have some plugins, like an MCP registry as well. And Tony from now Maple AI, mm-hmm, and Open Secret is, you know, using, as an example, he was giving some very nice feedback yesterday on Twitter. He likes the version of Open Agents that Christopher shipped. Mm-hmm. So there definitely are pockets. Bob, I think, is going to have a demo for us next week using eCash for MCP servers.
Anxiously awaiting that.
Yeah. I can't wait either.
There was good energy this week at Presidio Bitcoin.
Yeah. There was.
Working on.
And I think this gets to also that point, is I think one of the challenges is that the Bitcoin community has been so far outside of normal tech, partially because they're just like frustrated with all of the problems that we've discussed many times in the show, that maybe a little the baby got thrown out with the bathwater.
Yep.
And so maybe now we're starting to see some of these examples. Maybe Presidio Bitcoin is going to be ground zero. There's a lot more we can do with that. But I do think we are seeing more of the traditional Bitcoin builders using AI. I also think there's this huge question of, like, to your point, right? Like, I think there's something big. You know, I was listening to more traditional tech people talk about what is kind of, if you were trying to launch an attack into AI today, everything is so saturated and so competitive at the lab level, at the product level, mm-hmm, where would you even start? And they threw out all these different ideas. And one thing they totally missed in my mind is open payments. And what I mean by that is, I think whatever this integratable level of tools and data for the AI is going to be, now it seems to be MCP. And for those who haven't heard, this is a protocol put out by Anthropic. Tons of people are putting these servers out in the wild. And the server, I think the easy way I've seen to think of it is like just like a standard, like USB of like, okay, I have some data or some function or some tool calling, and I could open it as an API. But if I'd open it as an API, it's not clear how that plugs into Claude or any of these other models that, you know, they're going to have to go. You have to build some custom integration there. Whereas if everything runs its own MCP server, it's just easy. Okay, just plug in this tool or this data set into my AI agent, into Claude, wherever I'm using. But to me, like the big obvious thing that I want to see someone build is a registry of MCP servers and make it super easy to call that MCP server and pay.
I have an idea.
Please.
For a great time for someone to build that.
Okay.
And that's
during the show right now.
I'm DK. I'm on it.
The best idea is if it's happening right now with no one at the keyboard.
Yeah.
But how about we have a hackathon at Presidio Bitcoin, bringing together AI engineers, Bitcoin engineers, payment engineers, get them all in the same room, and come up with like 20 great ideas that we hack on. Or 3 days or a week or something.
Yeah.
So that's something. So there's a call to action to the audience.
30 minutes.
Anyone interested in doing that? Presidio Bitcoin's interested in that.
Yes.
Can contact any of us. But let's do that. Let's aim for like May.
Yeah. What's May? Like mid-May? Mid to end of May?
Something like that.
Before Memorial Day, right?
Yeah. So if anyone is interested in that or knows someone that should be here to do that, like, reach out to us for sure.
Yeah. And I mean, this is something I know we've chatted a little bit about. I would love, I mean, obviously do it here at Presidio Bitcoin. Hivemind, the fund that I run, would love to kick in for a potential prize here. Even like, you know, maybe people have ideas for specific bounties. Like one idea that I would love to see at this hackathon is, again, this registry of MCP servers that take a Lightning payment or an eCash payment. That's it. Like very, very simple idea.
Yeah.
But I think it'd be really cool if we come into the hackathon. Obviously, we get, you know, great energy from the AI community and the Bitcoin and eCash community, Nostr community, whatever. But I think, you know, just coming in with like 20 ideas of like, here are projects, like it's crazy. No one's built yet.
Here's my hope.
Yes.
We attract like a dozen or more 10X engineers, Silicon Valley stars. And then the first prize goes to David King.
Did I just swoop in there?
He's a 100X engineer.
He uses his AI tool to crush everyone. That's what I hope happens.
All right.
The judging will be totally unbiased.
Totally neutral, yeah.
Totally neutral.
Subtle dig there that David King is not a 10X engineer.
Yeah, no. Uh-oh. I think it's payback for the bike comp. I don't know.
But I want to see more kind of – It's great that we have Lightning kind of infrastructure things, but I want to see more people doing stuff. I feel like the breakthrough is going to come when we have like the right mix of, you know, it's like both sides of a marketplace. You need like good enough infrastructure to be able to build good apps. You need more apps that people care about to build better infrastructure. And I feel like this AI coding assistant thing unlocks this side of it. Yes. It makes it so you can make tons of things, and people who are non-technical can make whatever they want. And it just opens up so much more there, which then can start to pull the need for Lightning. I feel like everybody's still kind of in the mindset of like, hey, let's build a new Lightning infrastructure thing. And like, great, we do need that. But I feel like there's not enough energy toward let's make content or games or something that actually may use Lightning in a new way. Like, I don't feel like we have enough energy around that yet. So if I could kind of put out the call, that's the kind of thing that I want to see at like a hackathon.
Let me share an idea that we had a Lightning devs meetup last night at Presidio Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Really well attended, over 30 people here. It was awesome. Wow. And D++ was one of the moderators and leads. She kicked things off in a really fun way by having us play a game. So she hacked together a Super Mario game and added Lightning payments.
Oh, perfect. Oh, wow. Right? Yeah.
So you actually, like, when Mario gets a coin, you actually get, like, basically zapped Bitcoin.
Yep.
So that was really cool and it was fun. Crowd pleaser. But one of the people in the audience is like, this needs to be on Twitch. And I took a note to follow up with you, David, but let's just do it on the show right now.
Yeah.
Because I know you've been excited for a number of years about like doing a game show.
Oh, yeah.
Like high quality game show, and then incorporating Bitcoin. So it's not like a Bitcoin idea. It's like a great game show idea.
Yes.
But Bitcoin is a essential part of it, but like just part of it.
Yeah.
So I thought, I think this Twitch idea is brilliant, right? I imagine like everyone watching an e-game player be able to like send zats, sats to them, or like bet on them, or like while the player's playing the game, they earn sats. Like, what are your thoughts?
Totally. I mean, I think that the idea of a game show to me is compelling because it's like it's live, it's participatory. You could get everybody on a global stage playing this thing together, and we've seen like HQ Trivia was a game show quiz trivia show from like a while back. You know, maybe it was popular 10 years ago or something. But I feel like there's energy for like live experiences and like real global moments you could bring together. So I've been excited about that for a long time. I think actually all of the tools around how you create content are radically different today than even like a year ago, maybe when we may have last brainstormed around this. But I think you could do it with like a synthetic host. You don't actually need a person. You actually could have like some sort of a personality that you create. And you write scripts and you write backstory for them, but you let them perform it. And they can source quiz questions from Twitter, right? They can just pull in what happened in the last hour and let people answer that way.
Yep. So VTubers right now.
Yeah. And then you could stream that whole show.
I love that idea. And I've seen people like social media influencers, which has been a thing for a while now, might be like a dead end, right? You can just replace whether the person's like attractive or charming or humorous or whatever like is a draw for that person.
Or like really good at Bitcoin, knowledgeable about Bitcoin.
Just have an AI. Which actually, this show might not last forever.
Yeah, right. This will last another 6 months.
Been real, guys. Yeah.
we'll just let the AI.
Bitcoin's going to replace us with AI.
But you want to train. Want to train the AIs. Like you need to show like how you want to grow out your beard and how you want to sound. You know, all part of how you train an AI
to make
yourself relevant. And then we can go off and ride our bikes or, you know, sauna or whatever we want.
Yeah. That's true. But what about, get back to the, what David, what, or I mean, either of you guys, but what are your thoughts on utilizing Twitch? Because you get the live aspect that you just mentioned.
Yeah.
It's hugely popular for, with a big audience watching someone play games.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on utilizing that vehicle for Bitcoin
Davis? I mean, I think Twitch is great, but I think why not be everywhere? And especially why not also be on X, Twitter, because that's like there's so much movement around AI and interest and Bitcoin interest there. I think it's harder to build audiences on Twitch from scratch today. So I feel like it's focus on Twitter as your destination and then also go everywhere. You know, also go to YouTube, also go to Twitch. Like I don't know if there's anything unless you already have an audience on Twitch, I don't know if there's anything magical about making it exclusive to Twitch just because it has like a gamer theme. But I think you just build something new like this, push it out on, you know, on Twitter, on X. And, you know, they support live stuff, obviously. We're live right now on Twitter. So, yeah, I think like there's not enough focus on content in a sense. And content, you know, games are a form of content. Other types of storytelling. But there's a lot of, I mean, I'd say broadly, tech is focused on tech. And I think we're sort of entering a phase where pure tech is commoditized quickly. And so it's like an even harder race. You know, you think about back, I've been saying tech has just gotten so competitive today. Remember when Google launched, they were like very open about the algorithm and the research paper was published and like nobody did it for years.
Yeah.
Can you imagine today, OpenAI drops a new research paper, everybody's implemented it in like, you know, a couple weeks. It's so competitive today. So I think all of tech has, it's such a, you know, neck and neck race, and there's not really obvious, like, there's not really obvious ways that you sort of differentiate around tech early. Mm-hmm. But I think when you sort of marry some sort of content into tech, that's actually, you can create new experiences, emotional attachment, and those are the things that, like, you know, a game show could do, or a new type of, maybe there's new types of educators. Actually, one of the games I want to do is you take like a YouTube video, an educational YouTube video, and you create a quiz where you can real time kind of compete with a friend on a quiz and see who understood the video better, who understood the information in the video better. So just little things like that. I think things where you sort of start to pull content into the technology experience, to me, that's the future. And it's like, I feel like nobody's working on this stuff because historically tech is sort of very much like, well, we build the tech, you build the content, dear user. And I think, well, there's not enough crossover. There's not enough appetite for people to kind of cross over, which is why I'm thinking game show is good. You know, other types of trivia shows, other types of just stuff. The one versus 100 was actually one of the proposals. That was like an old school game show where you could actually play with a mob of people. So that mob could just be the internet. There's so many of these ideas that are just underexplored. And now they used to cost like $1 million to put all that content together. Now you can do it for like, you know.
So one question I have around this is like, we have seen some examples of this, you know, very smaller, much smaller audiences, but things like Zap.stream. So that's like a Nostr client where you can like whatever live stream like on YouTube and people can zap you. And like, that's at least cool because people can get your attention. And my understanding is I've never really used Twitch myself, but the people will like bomb their favorite Twitch streamers with whatever the local currency is. And like,
and YouTube has one too.
They do?
I think people could send us, you know, random, I don't know, drinks or whatever they send. I don't know. I haven't used it much.
So one big question I have.
A solicitation?
Yeah, exactly.
If you want to send us some drinks, send them over here.
We only accept Satsa. but the big question that I have, I guess, is, you know, what advantage do you get with using sort of this open payment protocol? It doesn't have to be Bitcoin. Like, it could be something like eCash or whatever versus just the in-game currency. I mean, it has to be like the ability to bring in audiences and, you know, from globally, payment networks globally, like one sort of like open place. Again, I start to think, I know you brought this up a lot, DK. It's probably going to be things that maybe are not allowed on YouTube or whatever that flourish there first. But like, what would be an example of like having open payments in a perhaps PG-13 environment that we actually do on this show? That, I don't know, is brand new or novel that, like, I don't know, that would necessitate Bitcoin a way you couldn't do on Twitch today.
I mean, I think like if you build a game and a core part of how the game works is you pay sats to play another round. Like, you used to have an arcade game and you put a quarter in.
Got it.
Like, why do we not have that model? And that, like, you can't really put a quarter into a game in that way, like, I don't know. You could like go to the app store and do payments, and there's various ways to that. But then you can also get paid. Mm. How would you get paid? Like, in the app store, you can't really do that, right? So there's like, payments are like a fundamental kind of break point, choke point in like all of these interesting new experiences. You can't kind of get money in and out very easily.
Yeah.
And if we just say, look, we've got all this great infrastructure and we got Lightning and stuff, like, figure it out, world. Nobody's going to figure it out. It has to be people who care about this stuff and understand this stuff who are like, actually, let's go build great content that's going to help showcase how awesome this is and then hopefully inspire, you know, thousands more.
Agreed. I'd like to see that. There's always the regulatory hurdle, though.
Yeah.
Like, if you're a centralized company, like, let's say you're an American company that builds an amazing game, that does payouts globally. Right. It's a perfect use case for Bitcoin because you can pay out anywhere. It's borderless money. Yep. It's valued around the world. But as an American company, they're probably, you know, once this grows to be something substantial, the regulators probably are going to like being able to pay out anyone anywhere in the world.
Yep.
And there might, you know, you'd have to analyze whether there's like money laundering opportunities for something like that as well. So that's always a barrier as well. But even with that barrier, it's still kind of disappointing. No one's still innovating and building out the kind of ideas you're sharing.
One crazy idea that comes to mind, and I agree with you on the regulatory hurdle, and maybe in this administration we finally will get a lot, like, I don't know, de minimis, like a couple $100. You can just zap and you don't have to do any kind of reporting. And that would probably open up a lot of use case in the U.S., just getting rid of, you know, having to pay tax or whatever on that. But one idea that comes to mind that's brand new and ties into some of the AI stuff we discussed last week is, imagine – so, again, this is probably me revealing that I'm a bit of an old head now, but, like, you know, watching other people play video games, to me, was at first I was like, that's like, man, you're like wasting so much time already. But it's huge. And like now, I guess probably, you know, globally, especially in Korea and stuff, more people, I think, watch esports than normal sports, or it's like
Max,
neck and neck.
We watch people play basketball.
Yeah, I know exactly. That's
we could
true.
Instead go out and play basketball ourselves, but we enjoy watching other people who are better than
because
us
because they're
basketball.
Very good at it. Exactly. Yeah, he has a very good point. I wish I played basketball more than watched, but yes, it's a good point. And so now I was thinking about this. I mean, one thing you could do is you could start having tournaments for AIs to play video games too. So just imagine like Dota and all those things that people like were originally training the AIs for, having tournaments, and maybe like what the humans do is they either, you know, get invested in following a certain AI, or maybe they're even involved in training their AI.
Mm-hmm.
But that seems pretty interesting to me. And the AIs get trained to get better, to be able to collect more payouts, either as the zaps or like the tournament pools. There seems like there's something there of like having AI only tournaments, and like to watch it, you have to pay and you know, lightning.
Yeah. It kind of reminds me of, have you seen the StarCraft AI? There was like a, you know, the team that did like AlphaFold, AlphaGo.
Yeah. I saw that, the recent documentary on.
Oh, yeah. The Demis Hassabis, right?
Yeah,
he did
good.
The thinking game.
Yeah.
Right?
It was very good.
Yeah, I saw that too. It was good.
Yeah.
But basically, they did this for StarCraft, right? Mm-hmm. And they even featured it in the movie.
Yeah.
So I think StarCraft is a great example where you can't necessarily play perfectly optimized. So it's a nice one to sort of be able to bet on. But they have, I think, a single AI that they built to do that. I haven't seen like more coming up around that. But that seems like the kind of thing, you know, you certainly wouldn't want to do tic-tac-toe, you know, with AIs playing it.
And then eventually we're going to start seeing betting markets for the AI games. And you're going to see like AIs like, hey, like, why is he missing that that free throw? A little point shaving happening here with the AIs.
Right. Yeah. So what do you think is the how do you think, where do we go from here? Is it just the hackathon is the next thing and sort of
hackathon.
Thing. Okay. Yeah, let's do it.
I'm gonna hack on things, and if I ever get anything interesting up, I'm gonna try to get it out. So I'll share it with you guys at least. And we can,
now you've publicly committed. So
yeah. Well, I intend to do something. I don't know. Right now I'm kind of just struggling to get something that is good, that's like at least good enough to play with. It doesn't have to be awesome, but it has to be like something we can actually play with.
Yeah.
Right now it's not there.
I think what would be awesome, maybe anyone that's listening to this, assume you heard it here first. We're going to have an AI and Bitcoin hackathon here at Presidio Bitcoin. If you have one, I mean, you want to participate, reach out, or two ideas, I think we should start putting together an RFP, like a request for proposals. Obviously, people come up with their own ideas as well, but I think that might help get a lot of people off of zero. It's just like, here's 20 things that haven't been built that we could come up with. And so if you have those ideas, drop them in the chat. Let's get it in a doc. And
you mentioned March Madness.
Yes. Oh, yeah. I have something I want built. I came in and asked Steve. Okay, DK, we have a first project request for you or whoever's listening today.
What is March Madness, Max?
Oh, man.
Our audience, maybe some don't know.
I don't know.
I know David.
Wow. Okay, then let me take a giant step
I've
back.
Heard of it, but yeah.
So some of us like basketball, and some of us like watching other people play basketball, Steve and myself included. And both of us have teams. My team's Memphis. His team's Iowa State.
Iowa State.
And both of these teams, presumably nothing crazy, barring anything crazy, should be at least decently seeded in the tournament here, which is pretty exciting. So 64 teams, all college basketball. I don't know. There's people that are into college basketball, this is kind of like the mecca of the year. It's a big deal.
The Super Bowl.
The Super Bowl, you could say. but it's more fun than a Super Bowl because, you know, what's fun about college basketball, or at least historically, although with NIL, this is kind of changing, is there's a little bit more parity than in most sports. And partially because the field of 64, the people that are playing in the tournament, there's enough teams that, you know, even if you're not that good on any given day, the chance of an upset from, let's say, like a mid-tier team beating a really good team, it's like much higher than it would be in the
NFL. High volatility.
Much higher volatility. Okay.
And next Thursday and Friday, there's 32 games. So when you have that many games with what you just said, there's going to be every year there's upsets and drama. Great basketball.
Yeah, right. You're going to get like, oh my God, that ref, he called that. He shouldn't have called that over the back at the end.
And gambling. It's very, you know, lots of casual gambling.
Yep.
Potential Bitcoin payment.
Potential
thing.
Which no, I'm serious. Like, if anyone's listening to this, I mean, I would say, oh shit, there's not enough time this year. We'll have to wait till next year. But no, now that I know that we have vibe coders out there,
I mean, there are people who could definitely do this.
This
I probably
can't,
but
today.
I bet somebody could do this.
So
by the end of the day,
request for proposal that we may or may not use, depending on what our legal status allows. But here at Presidio Bitcoin, there should be a prize pool. So historically, when I was in middle school, this is when I started playing this. This is probably legal at school because the teachers would do it. But we would actually come in, we would all print out brackets, right? And you've got the whole whatever 64, some change teams. You pick who you think is going to win in each round. You go all the way in, and there's like points for if you get the first round versus the Sweet 16 or whatever. Anyways, point is like someone gets the most points at the end, and then that money is divided up, and there's a first prize, second prize, third prize, however you want to make the prize pool. So it's a little bit of gambling. One could argue perhaps a game of skill as well.
And you're using your lunch money?
I don't know what we're using. It was somehow, yeah, I guess. I mean, these are pretty low amounts.
If we're gambling Bitcoin, it's not our lunch money.
Exactly. So, I mean, if someone came in and said,
your generational wealth.
Yeah, there's, you know, 100,000 sat buy-in. So someone should build a bracket online where you buy into the pool and provably it's fair and it pays out.
Could you do something like that? Because we spent a lot of time with Nostr. Could you use Nostr as like the publishing mechanism so you're not really like running the thing? You're just like, it's just out there?
Yeah.
Like, where's the choke point or pinch point in that?
Well, you need the bracket itself is published by the NCAA. So what you would need to do is, I guess, host a place for people to make their selections. So just like who's going to win between, you know, Iowa State and Kansas or whatever, and then boom, and then you just go all the way in. So you need someone to, I guess, host the different selections that a user or a pub key makes. So I guess you could have multiple relays doing that.
And you need like an oracle that says like, you know, this team won.
Right.
So this is a great idea, and it's it's timely, you know, given it's March.
Yeah.
But I think of something with even bigger potential, since Bitcoin's global, borderless, would be like the world's favorite sport, which is soccer, or as not Americans say, football.
It's not college basketball.
I'm just surprised there's not some kind of gambling, extremely popular gambling app around.
And global,
fantasy football or... Again,
do they have the same
soccer
dynamics
or
around
some other betting game around?
I mean, the World Cup. Yeah. I mean, the World Cup is next year, 26. Whoever, like, someone should really build up and make what we're talking about, but for the World Cup, and that thing could go viral.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that because it is more global in nature, which is really where Bitcoin shines.
It's going to be hosted here in California as well. So
that feels kind of lame.
Is that? They're hosting World Cup here?
Yeah. Well, it's all over the United States.
I think it's a
Canada
joint.
Mexico.
Yeah, it's North America.
Oh, okay. Cool. So, we've talked vibe coding.
Which might all be the United States by that time. I don't know.
Greenland.
Yeah.
Happening in Greenland. So we talked vibe coding. We talked fintech, tech bro stuff. Do you have other must-do topics? Or
I think you had some controversy.
Well, we could talk. I mean, there's several things to it.
How about open source conspiracy theories? Yeah. Is that
we'll do? Hold on, let's start with a little lighter weight topic.
Okay,
I don't know if this,
we've been
this,
so deep.
This gets controversial as well.
Good.
You shared Jameson Lopp posted about checkpoints have been removed from Bitcoin.
I want to hear about this.
This is just interesting maybe for people to know about, because like when I went down the rabbit hole and started learning about Bitcoin in
back
a really
when you were a
10x way.
Bitcoin engineer
back in like 2017.
He made a contribution to Bitcoin, right?
I did. Yes, the repository. I'm officially a Bitcoin Core contributor.
Ooh, what was the contribution?
I added a line of logging code.
Ooh.
But it got
merged.
Dude, yes. Felicidades. It's a big deal.
So the, you know, the narrative that I was hearing was that, or I shouldn't just say it, a fact, like most of the blockchains definitely took shortcuts to get around gnarly problems.
Yeah.
And the narrative around Bitcoin was that it was more pure. Like, for example, reorging the blockchain, like in theory, you can reorg it all the way back to the Genesis block. So if you install Bitcoin software for the first time from scratch, the process is to download 800 and some thousand blocks from peers because there's no central server, right? So if you get that concept in your head, who do you download it from? There's no, you don't go to Google or Satoshi.com to download your blocks. So you get randomly assigned peers, other Bitcoin software, just like your Bitcoin software, to download those blocks. And you can you don't have to download them from all one source. You can connect to, I think the default is 8 peers. And
it's just giving you like a bunch of IP addresses of people.
Yeah, there's like
core.
A starter list, but then it kind of gets randomized. But part of the design is you can like double check all the work and make sure that you actually have like the best chain. Because of course your peers could lie to you. They could feed you blocks that are not true. So anyway, the narrative around Bitcoin is that, like, you know, you can start from scratch and that's generally true, but for, you know, basically for 10 plus years, there's been checkpoints in the Bitcoin core software, so pretty much the Bitcoin network. I think it's like every 100,000 blocks or so, the code has been added to say, like, this is the 100,000th block. This is the 200,000th block. So it's introducing this truth into the code,
mm-hmm.
which is not pure.
Right.
That's against the narrative that Bitcoiners want to believe.
And now, that's just like it says block 100,000 should match this hash or something.
Yep. Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
And if you get something else, then that person who sent it to you is lying to you. That's what you're trying to correct.
Yeah. Okay. And it's pragmatic, but it's certainly not pure.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why it's problematic to the narrative and problematic in general is that it's a centralization point. That means just a handful of devs can like add to the code. We think this is truth.
Yeah, yeah.
And then everyone installs that. And so a handful of – and the devs don't want that kind of power.
And why was it introduced?
Yeah, so it's like, okay, why not just remove that? It was due to denial of service attack vulnerabilities. If those were removed, peers could send you really low proof of work blocks headers to a peer and flood your computer
mm-hmm.
and basically crash your computer.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like a way to DOS the network.
And was that actively happening, or just people were?
No, just they're smart. Smart developers on Bitcoin.
It might happen,
adversarial thinkers.
Adversarial thinkers, right? And so that was the threat, and that's why it wasn't easily removed. So it took like years and years and years and years to come up with a mechanism to address that in like a more proper way. And that was done, I think, in 2022, so like 3 years ago. But what Jameson just announced and like what was just merged like yesterday in the Bitcoin Core software is the removal of the checkpoints themselves. There's been enough like fuzz testing and different types of testing to satisfy a bunch of core devs that, it's a risky change getting rid of this. But a handful of core devs feel like it's been thoroughly tested, thoroughly done. It's now been removed from the core code base. So the next release will remove the checkpoint.
And how do they now fight the DDoS potential without the checkpoints?
I'm not super deep on the specifics, but now I think you have to fetch the headers twice from each peer and it sort of splits it up into like a two-stage process.
You've fetched the same header from two peers, like to cross-validate, or
that makes sense, but I don't know if that's how it works. But I'm not familiar on the specifics.
Well, one thing I think it's nice worth noting is sort of the philosophical point you bring up here. I mean, the specifics of this are very interesting. I think it also just gives us to show we all take for granted like the extremely smart, meticulous, boring, often but hard work of all like the core devs that make all this stuff work, which is awesome. But to me, the really nice thing that you're pointing out, and it's like a nice reminder on Bitcoin and in Nostr as well, and I think this is where I think a lot of people perhaps struggle to accept our Bitcoin community's point of view, which is that the point of view that you're suggesting, when you have a peer-to-peer network, and in many ways, probably the most similar analogy most people don't understand is if anyone ever, you know, was in college and used torrents and had sort of peer-to-peer seeding, like similarly, you're not just downloading it from one site. The whole point is you have lots of peers and you're seeding it from lots of places. Very similar sort of idea there. And I think what this requires people to accept is what I believe is a self-evident truth about the universe, which is there is no truth. There's only, you know, at least we know of 8 billion perspectives, maybe way more perspectives that all see things. And there's a lot of overlap. And the more, you know, let's say proof of work that accrues over time, the higher the probability that this is, in fact, the 100,000th block. But there's nothing, there is no one centralized truth of source of truth. And so much of our modern tech stack is built around this idea of like, no, there is like a specific time this happened. So, no, there's not. There's what Twitter says happened, but you're accepting that's one point of view. And in Bitcoin land and in Nostr land, you're accepting
even
there is
the
no.
I agree. And even the concept of time.
Even like, especially the
which can
of time.
Be lied about. Like when a miner mines a block, they include a timestamp.
Yes.
And that can be accurate or inaccurate. And if it's inaccurate, it might be just their computer's clock is out of sync or yep. it's malicious. So I think we've talked about that in a past show,
yeah, yeah.
How that works.
The
in
wall
Bitcoin.
Clock. I was not aware of the wall clock. The Bitcoin knows wall clock time.
Yeah. But I'd like to second Max's shout out to core developers, because a change like this, it takes many years. You have to be super meticulous. It's not sexy at all.
Yeah.
Like users aren't like right. rejoicing around the world.
Oh, thank God. There's no more checkpoints.
Because their experience of Bitcoin is better. No one's rejoicing about it. But I think the core developers get a lot of hate from other developers frequently because they're not paying attention or prioritizing like what other developers want or other users want. And I mean, that's a good discussion to have, but it's not like they're lazy and resting in their laurels. They are doing important work. And then a second thing is, you know, Michael Saylor talked about, you know, not the importance of not changing Bitcoin, not introducing risk. And I think that's a great conversation as well. And it's super nuanced and varied though. Right. So, I think he has good points there, but it depends on the details. So if he's saying like, if someone's saying like we should never change any software again, that's just not practical
with
how software works.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, there's some changes that literally have to be made. Like when there's new processors introduced, new operating systems, things change. You have to change the software or else it won't work anymore.
Yeah,
or you'd have to use a computer from like 20 years in the past or
right.
something. Right? So just there's things that you have to do. Now this change, one can make the argument, and I saw people on X making the argument that the counterpoint that this shouldn't have been done. The removal of checkpoints shouldn't have been done because it introduces risk with a change. And it's true. It does introduce risk with that change. So it's certainly a reasonable discussion or debate about whether to make that change. However, you know, it again, the fundamental reason for making that change is to remove the centralization point. And there remain many centralization points within Bitcoin, and it's a dynamic environment. Those centralization points change over time because human nature is to centralize. So new centralization points will crop up, and in some cases you need to change the software to address it.
Right.
One thing this also makes me, I mean, I 100% agree with you. I also get the spirit of what Saylor's saying, and I have to believe he understands the reality of this as well. But, I mean, of course, like software is a living, breathing organism. If you just never, you know, touch it, then like you said, at the very least, your operating system is no longer supported, you know, in a couple of years.
Right.
So it's just not possible. This also gets me excited on the AI front. Something we talked a lot about with digital life and like self-organizing systems themselves there. Maybe in the future, you know, you can have bots that are also sort of check on the individual human perspectives as devs here that are saying, actually, no, like, you know, here's whatever version of Bitcoin Core that we've whatever, updated to run on Linux version, whatever version we're on one day. And, you know, people obviously can still debate it and people can review it and all this stuff. But I think the more we see, and I think AI is going to make this very obvious, but that software is living and breathing, like, I don't know, the better off or closer to reality people are.
That's actually an interesting point to imagine. There's a future probably where AIs would try to make contributions to Bitcoin Core.
They will.
Right?
I think they already are.
Already are.
To yeah.
Like raising pull requests and stuff?
Open source projects. I just saw some developers on my own team ask about that. I didn't investigate it, but the reaction I saw was that, like, it's pretty easily detected right now. So you can, like, sort of safely ignore it. But this absolutely seems like good, like with everything, good and bad,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, so obviously, if it's AI that's suggesting or opening a pull request with a change that's healthy and positive, awesome.
Yeah.
But you can imagine denial of service attacks too, right?
Yeah.
Meaning not a DOS attack on software, but a DOS attack on
too
the
many
developers.
Changes, yeah.
Yeah.
If all the developers do is, like, look through a gazillion PRs that are generated by AI and are actually nonsense, that's wasting their time.
But I think it sort of points to the importance of sort of deciding and prioritizing what to merge. Because presumably if, like, AIs are developing a lot of suggestions of what to merge, the person who decides what to merge, who has final authority on that, should be able to also use an AI to help them prioritize the list. So it's a little bit of cat and mouse game, right?
Yep. Another cat and mouse game would be consensus changes, right? There's been lots of discussion in different Bitcoin consensus changes the past few years, particularly around covenants. And there's many different proposals, and people get frustrated. Like, people who are for proposal A get frustrated that other people don't care or don't listen or don't get on board, and then someone has, you know, option B and C and D.
Yep.
Imagine AI producing, like, thousands and thousands of options, but no one really knows, you know, is it AI or is it a human proposing this stuff? That can get chaotic as well.
Yeah, and I think I actually did a pod this week, hopefully it will release next week, with Franz Zapp, who's a developer in Nosterland, and he's been working on Zapp Store, so it's like a sort of an open alternative to the App Store.
Yep.
I was suggesting maybe he should be building an App Store for AIs, which is more like the MCP server store. So that's we'll see if that goes anywhere. But I think I would say the biggest takeaway from our conversation is, you know, in this world of just information abundance, the two scarcities that I know of are Bitcoin and attention. And attention is still, I think, the most valuable thing in the world. And I think it's a good reminder on both of your points there, but particularly with what you were saying with the developers and needing the AI agents, very soon, even if, you know, whatever, we have dozens of really, really good core developers, there's literally no chance any of us, including them, are going to be able to withstand the onslaught of just information DDoS. We're already DDoSed every day. And so I think something I don't know what the answer is, but, like, the number one thing that I want to see, as Kevin Kelly always says, is, you know, technology used to solve the problems of technology is, and I don't know if this is going to use Nostr somehow with the public private key signing, if this is going to use, you know, whatever, just teams of agents. But the thing that I'm increasingly wanting in my own life is, you know, how do I order and prioritize information? Like, there's so much coming at me nonstop. Like, I just want, you know, a team of my own agents that says, based on this web of trust, maybe on Nostr or however they filter it, here's what you actually need to look at. And I think this is going to be true for software developers. It's going to be true for us choosing stories. It's going to be true for everyone. Like, the faster we figure out how to use AI, ideally, and this is why I think local open source, or at least open source AI, is so important, where we can see the inputs, where we can see the algorithms it's feeding us. I think that ability to protect ourselves from the onslaught is the single most important legacy of AI. And I haven't seen a lot of great examples of it yet.
I think today is group chat.
So we're the algo.
Yeah. I mean, we're the algo for each other, right? Like, you share something with me there, I'm much more likely to be interested to read it, regardless of where it's published. It's published on Nostr, great, it's published on Twitter, that's fine.
And in-person spaces, right?
Yeah.
So if we're inundated with consensus change proposals online, and we don't know who, you know, it's from some NIM who might be a human developer with great intentions and they just want to protect their identity and their privacy. Or is it, like, you know, the CIA bot who's trying to, like, destroy Bitcoin, right?
Yeah.
So we don't know. But if people come to electricity of Bitcoin.
Tying it back to the market.
Like, it still might be, we still might have a mole here, someone who's working for the CIA.
Almost certainly.
Maybe
it's
Max.
The one with asteroid theories.
But we at least know that it's in human form. Let's talk about spiral conspiracy.
Yeah.
Right, you wanted to talk about that?
I didn't.
Something spicy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's also tied to the topic of like
open source
core developers and stuff like that. Because I'm the one that replied on X about, is this a spiral conspiracy? But someone was saying, the general topic is about, developers being funded. And then that introducing bias in their work for open source.
Right.
And to that point, I think that's inarguable that that's like a concept. Something
it
that
may exist. We have to evaluate.
It may exist.
We can't dismiss it.
Definitely can't dismiss it. The opportunity for bias is there. So I think it's really important for Bitcoin community and Bitcoin evangelists and champions and developers to monitor that. So speaking specifically for Spiral, anyone we're funding, like, people should be critical of, like, the work they do. Is it directionally correct for Bitcoin? Is anything nefarious going on? Like, absolutely. Like I've said from day one, that should be monitored because Spiral is funded by Block, a big corporation, U.S. public company. Are we doing what's best for Bitcoin? I consider and say, of course, like, I'm a Bitcoiner. I would only do what's best for Bitcoin. That is my intention, but like maybe I'm wrong, maybe I'm missing something, or maybe I'm not being truthful, right? We need to question everything, so everyone should monitor that and give feedback. However, I'm not aware of anything nefarious going on with Spiral developers or with any developers who have received grants. So
are there specific claims that people are making?
What's
that
the conspiracy? Is
it just like generally there could be a problem? Or?
Someone posted that devs funded by grants were going around promoting soft fork activation clients to miners. And I'm not aware of a single example. And I pushed back on that and still haven't heard an example. I can give you examples of people who are doing that, but they're not funded by grants for open source development. They either work for a startup who wants a change like that, or they invented the change themselves, but aren't funded, as far as I know, by an open source development group. So there are no concrete examples that I'm aware of. And I think it's dangerous to make claims like that without substance either. So I think it's important to monitor and be vigilant and call out Spiral or any HRF or Brink or whatever, Chaincode, call out those organizations if anything nefarious is happening, but don't like imply that something like that is happening if it's not. Because it comes back to actually to Michael Saylor and some of his concerns that I've heard him say, which are in theory, or I mean, his concerns are like with all the soft fork, all the consensus changes, kind of feeling like chaotic and risky. And I think it's really important to like distinguish that type of work. And the thing that I really focus on is like the around activation, like doing R&D and coming up with new ideas and then testing them out.
Yeah.
Both like actual software tests, but also testing out the ideas with others and getting feedback. That's a super healthy process. Yeah. And I am a very big
more exploration
proponent of
another
controversy on X is like Spiral fund that? And yes, Spiral would fund that type of work. But when you cross the line into like what I would call premature activation talk, that's where I think it's like unhealthy and just not really following a good process. So if people make claims that like devs funded by grants are doing that type of work, that's why. I mean, Michael Saylor said he doesn't want to fund developers doing that type of work.
Right.
A point I made to him is that, like, if you look at everyone Brink is funding, Chaincode's funding, Spiral's funding, none of them are doing that type of work. So I just think it's dangerous making those types of claims.
So his so far, I know that they have a lot to gain and lose in the Bitcoin world. Are they currently considering, or have they considered, or where are they on sort of making grants to kind of Bitcoin developers?
Michael Saylor and Strategy?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not sure. But I, you know, I think they'll get there. And I, you know, they are, I think from their corporate office, or first of all, they're opening up a physical space somewhat similar to Presidio Bitcoin and Bitcoin Park. That's cool.
They're doing it at
where?
Where's
in
that
DC area? Okay. Maryland, DC area. And they are all, you know, they've been hosting Bit Devs there for like maybe half a year or so. So that's a step in the right direction, I think.
That's cool.
And yeah, so would love to see more engagement on that. But the other thing that I see raised a lot around bias and influence and stuff, and we touched on this in the Bitcoin Consensus Analysis Project, BCAP, like the emergence of BlackRock and ETFs and the U.S. government even.
Right.
Like if BlackRock starts funding core devs, like that's something I've heard over and over again.
Totally.
Where people are worried about that. Again, I absolutely agree that we should be vigilant and monitor that. I'm far less concerned than other people, though, that will actually lead to any issues, because let's say BlackRock funded a bunch of developers to do nefarious things and they tried to introduce those into the Bitcoin Core project. It doesn't just like automatically get in.
Right.
Like the number of resources, people, money they have, there's still a bunch of contributors to the Bitcoin Core project that would say, no, that's wrong. Here's the technical reasons. Here's the problem. And if it was something more political, then like users, like a much broader base of people would be like, no, we don't want to run that Bitcoin software. Yeah. So even if they created a fork of Bitcoin Core, created their own Bitcoin implementation, people have to adopt that as well.
I think this also touches on an interesting point, which I think is very true for Bitcoin. It also has come out in some recent criticisms of Nostr that I've read as well. And I've actually heard this from multiple people, including an essay that we passed around a little bit this morning as well. And the fundamental claim there was that, you know, how much of so less nefarious that people are trying to push in malicious updates, but more in this case, you know, with organizations like OpenSats, how much is that potentially skewing like what the market actually wants in terms of, you know, for something like Nostr, like how many of these developers would survive if they weren't funded, you know, by an open source organization. I think that's fair for Bitcoin in general. And then I've seen another sort of class of criticisms, which does this create in all of these cases, sort of like political elites, where, you know, you made the point of like, hey, it's great that we have in-person spaces that you know, help fight some of this DDoS attacks, but obviously that creates, you know, whether we wanted to or not, political hierarchies as well. And you have friends and you work with your friends. And I think these are all really interesting questions. I think one, politics is inevitable. Anyone thinks that you know, open source project is going to remain pure and open, whatever pure even means, right? But open on the internet, like it's never going to happen. There's always human politics that it's better, I think, if that happens more open than not. But I think that's a reality. I do think it's another interesting question, which is, you know, at what point, I think a lot of the donations, you know, for funding open source work comes, I think, almost universally from a very good, beautiful, noble place. I do think it's a fair question to ask, you know, if it's coming, if the money flow is not clear, it's a lot more questionable what the motive is. Like in some ways, I'm actually much happier to see, you know, if I know the money's coming from an individual that, you know, for whatever reason is really into Bitcoin or holds a lot of Bitcoin, it's like, okay, well, you know, you could certainly see that this person's incentive is to protect their investment. If it's from a company, I'm also very comfortable with that, because it's like, well, you know, even if the company is doing something nefarious, it's not that hard to guess what the nefarious thing might be. It's, you know, support some work of the company. If it's a black box, I can see that's a little bit more concerning, especially because the amounts you might need to, you know, potentially fund a developer, it's pretty low relative to what an intelligence community or whatever might need to actually put in there. But I don't know. I think these are interesting set of questions. I personally am of the view that the answer to this is not to like bitch and moan about other people doing it, but if you don't like the way it's being done, like start your own or find a way, like go out there and find donors. I think the answer in my mind is, you know, more kinds of capital funding more kinds of work. And so, you know, this criticism I was reading of the Nostr community and like having too many like side projects that are going nowhere or whatever, it's like, you know, this is still the experimentation phase. And if you really believe that, one way to do that is to recruit and find entrepreneurs, which is kind of what I'm trying to do with, you know, my fund at HiveMind, which say, no, like the people we fund, you know, there's an explicit commercial relationship. We're trying to build a business on top of that as well. And you know, maybe over time what needs to be funded by open source changes, and hopefully there's more, you know, business opportunities. But I do think it's, I don't know, it's interesting, like, whenever people are complaining about that, I think the more positive sort of action is figure out if you don't like the way this money is being funneled, to raise your own and find a way to funnel it elsewhere.
Yep. Cool. I know we are just about over time now, so should we?
Well, we got a late start.
Okay.
Should we do maybe one more topic?
Well, I've got one on this that I wanted to.
Still spicy?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's something that I don't have as much kind of hands-on research or experience with that at least Steve does. I don't know if you do too, but if you, we've been talking about sort of how these, you know, the motivation or potential motivation or corrupt motivation of the funders of Bitcoin core devs. But like, can we turn it the other side and like, what is a Bitcoin core dev? Like, what motivates a Bitcoin core dev? Are they like, what are the, you know, you've met a lot of these people. How would you characterize what motivates them to work on Bitcoin?
Yeah, I mean, there's a generalization, but I think it's true for almost every core dev I know. They're mission driven. They really believe in Bitcoin, the project. And again, everyone has maybe a different view of what Bitcoin is, but I mean, in general, it would be this self-sovereign money, at the adversarial mindset, just making sure that sort of understanding the history of digital money and the projects that have failed,
mm-hmm.
and how they ultimately had a centralization choke point, and working super hard towards preventing that happening to Bitcoin. I think they're very driven by that. So that can include security, privacy, DOS attacks, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what motivates them. It's clearly not money, because they can make a lot more money working on other software jobs. And yeah, I think there's also this notion that, like, oh, all the core devs, like, are Bitcoin billionaires because they own Bitcoin early on. And, I mean, I have no idea how much each core dev, how much Bitcoin they own, but I doubt very many fit that profile. I think a lot of OG holders of Bitcoin sold a lot of Bitcoin because, like, when it went from $2 to $32, that's a massive gain, and you sold a lot, right?
Right.
And they also had to, like, pay for the rent, right? So
and they didn't come into this as, like, already a billionaire or something, right, like some people entering now. And then also, a lot of the core developers joined later too, you know, not when Bitcoin was $2. So
mm-hmm.
anyway, I don't think money motivates them. I think it's the mission and the ethos.
Yeah, I think one interesting example is from the core devs I've met, it feels a lot like maybe certain contributors to other open source projects, or like what I imagine early contributors to the internet felt like, what I imagine like projects like Wikipedia. And something that always gets me, like, Wikipedia is an example where I think it's like 0.1% of the contributors do like 99% of the work there. I do think there is this kind of like this truism that, you know, whatever, some tiny, far less than 1% of, like, incredibly talented, motivated, and, like, frankly, just good-hearted people, like, keep a lot of the world together. And I think these are an example of a couple dozen that are doing that.
Yeah, I like the I would agree, like, ethos-wise, similar to other open-source projects, and because those projects, what they have in common is there's not a lot of money to be made. It's more volunteer-based. Maybe you get some sponsorship. But and contrast that to pretty much every other blockchain project,
right,
which is far more mirrors a VC-funded company in the way that coins are pre-mined, just like equity, and they get far more compensation, and there's sort of the rush and speed of a Silicon Valley startup. So they're two completely different worlds. And so sometimes people make comparisons about how many developers are on such and such a blockchain project compared to Bitcoin developers.
Yeah.
However, I think on the metric of like longevity and who's going to stick around when things aren't going so great, it's going to be the Bitcoin developers. Because when the money dries up on some other blockchain project, in fact, I think we just saw Ethereum Foundation is like leveraged and could potentially be liquidated and lose some or all their money. I don't know, but
that'll,
like,
contribute to the decentralization of it. Huh?
Exactly. Yeah, every blockchain project, you know, they raise so much money and ultimately they're going to spend it down. And then are the developers actually going to stick around for ethos reasons? I think unlikely. Whereas Bitcoin, you pretty much
it selects for that
self-selection because there isn't like pre-mined tokens to give those developers.
Right. Cool. We got any time to transition to something or?
Yeah. Let's do Bitwise ETF. Yeah. I mean, we have that or vaults. We can introduce both really quickly.
Okay.
But Bitwise ETF, I mean, maybe one of you guys want to.
So Bitwise is this company, one of the like the startup that manages ETFs. There's, you know, the BlackRock runs the big ETFs. And Bitwise is a startup, actually a Silicon Valley startup. I happen to be an early backer of the thing. I like the guys a lot. I didn't really know what they were going to do. But they ended up building this, one of the first ones that launched, you know, one of the first Bitcoin ETFs that launched back when they all launched, you know, a dozen of them or so launched. And they've now created a new ETF product, which is meant to give people the ability to simply get exposure to all of the companies that fit a certain criteria around holding a certain amount of Bitcoin in their treasury, some liquidity and other kinds of filters. But they launched this, I think, in the past week or so. And so I thought the number was, is it 1,000? You need to have 1,000 Bitcoin on 1,000 your balance
Bitcoin
sheet.
1,000 Bitcoin is one criteria.
Is one kind of headline criteria.
So like Block and Coinbase and Tesla and obviously Strategy are all on there. So another, it is market weighted based on the number of Bitcoin the companies hold.
Oh, interesting.
But with a cap because otherwise Strategy would.
It would be the whole ETF.
It would basically be the same. It would be a proxy for Strategy. So there's a cap.
Yeah.
And then through that, I learned that Fold, which is a Bitcoin startup that just IPO'd, I really hadn't studied their financials or anything, but I was somewhat surprised they have over 1,000 Bitcoin on their their treasury, which is amazing. But I think one of you guys pointed out how this might incentivize companies to put Bitcoin on their balance sheet so that they can be included in this index.
Or if you're at 800, maybe get... Yeah. You know, buy another couple hundred, and you know. So I think it's just incentives all around. Yeah.
One big question I have around this. I mean, one, I think it's awesome. I think I, you know, also a big fan of the Bitwise guys. They've been great stewards of the community in terms of giving back, and I think they're always, you know, looking for new angles. So I think it's cool, and I think it's awesome that maybe it incentivizes leaders to become Bitcoin leaders. On the other hand, I guess one of my questions is like, who is this really marketed towards? Because in my mind, it's like I come back to our first topic on the show. It's like all of these are kind of these like. Kind of derivative plays of like I'm long Bitcoin. Who is the investor that's like, hey, I really believe in Bitcoin, but you know what? I'm not just going to go buy Bitcoin.
I think there's a lot of people who have Bitcoin exposure, but then they need traditional financial system exposure for one reason or another,
and they don't want all of their eggs in the MicroStrategy bucket.
They might not want. I mean, that's highly volatile, and they want to sort of get a different profile of risk for those assets, right? So if you could buy a Bitcoin ETF, and that's going to give you a Bitcoin profile of risk, but there's other ways to create value in the world. There's companies that are very small that get very big, that's one way to create and participate in value. And so I would say this is a cut of the world that demonstrates like the founders, CEOs, the board believes they're forward thinking enough about Bitcoin to believe that Bitcoin is worth holding. And so is that going to beat the traditional, you know, go VOO, some broad S&P 500 index, which includes both people who are forward-thinking enough, but it includes mostly people who are not that forward-thinking.
Yeah.
So in a sense, it's a cut on who actually is thinking about where the world's going. I think it's actually a pretty reasonable cut to get an index across some industries of kind of forward-thinking tech leaders.
Yep, I agree. I think that's interesting. Should we touch on vaults really quick?
Yeah, let's do it.
This is like an hour-long discussion, but we'll tease it now and maybe talk about it.
Yeah. Just there's a little bit of drama, you said, right?
Drama. Well, I mean, so the concept of a vault... one example is like Coinbase for at least 7-8 years, if not longer, has offered a feature called Vault, in which if you hold Bitcoin with Coinbase, maybe the default is to have it in their hot wallet. But if you put it in the vault, it goes into their cold storage. And what does that mean? Well, that means if I want to withdraw my Bitcoin from Coinbase or send it somewhere or spend it, I have to wait 48 hours until it sort of gets unlocked out of the vault and I can do that. So slight nuisance for me if I want to transfer my Bitcoin, but it's a protective measure in case someone hacks into my account, fishes me or somehow tricks me to get into my account and they try to withdraw the Bitcoin. If there's no protection, they could withdraw it right away and then you're pretty screwed.
And River has something very similar with Force Field now.
Right. And then you get... you know, and then so if someone does, if a hacker does start trying to attempt removing your Bitcoin from the vault, you get notification messages through different mediums. So that is the concept of vault at the application layer, meaning River and Coinbase have implemented this themselves. It's not built into the Bitcoin protocol. Now, there's also been attempts to do it at the Bitcoin protocol level, and there's a startup called Liana, which has built out a vault product with today's Bitcoin consensus rules, which are not the friendliest rules to create a vault structure, but they've done it. There's some caveats, drawbacks, but they did build that product, and I don't think they've reported they've not been super successful at forming partnerships or gaining customers for that concept. Now, there's a number of people who have suggested different covenant proposals which would improve both the ease of implementing vaults at the protocol layer and creating a better UX. And so the drama or the discussion this past week, and it's been ongoing, is how much adoption would we actually see of vaults at the protocol level, even with a covenant change? And is that like a motivating use case to make a consensus change to Bitcoin? That's the underlying issue here. So vault, that there are many vault proponents, and they will say, of course, it would be adopted, or I would adopt it, or this company would adopt it, or my company would adopt it. In fact, Rob Hamilton from AnkorWatch, we covered AnkorWatch a month or so ago, super interesting product. He's saying like our product would adopt this, right? So there's proponents like that. But there's also a large contingent of respected people in the space too, which are saying it's not as simple or as easy as people are making out. There's a number of complications with it. One of which is that it requires live monitoring. It needs like a watchtower.
Yeah.
So it introduces all this complexity, and it goes from like it's already hard to manage one set of keys or like one wallet. Now with vaults, you have to manage two sets of keys. So it's a little bit shifting the problem.
And just to make sure I understand, live monitoring means like not only do I have my own kind of cold storage wallet, but in addition to that, if I've sent those to addresses that might have this kind of vaulting behavior, I would need to separately run a computer that is the watchtower.
Or rely on
somebody else's watchtower.
Yeah, somebody else, yeah.
So, and again, the concept here would be...
must leak privacy.
I have my wallet. I mean, it's a good question. That would need to be explored too. I suspect there's ways to address that. But the idea is like a person has their cold storage, their Bitcoin savings, and they want a setup where if somehow their keys are compromised and someone tries to steal it, they don't just immediately get to steal it. Instead, there's a window of time, say 48 hours or a week or... You know, it can be configurable. Those coins, if you detect someone trying to, there's a time lock basically, and if someone's trying to transfer them, you as the rightful owner have an ability to interject and send them to another predefined address. And that could be like another wallet you're managing instead of keys, or it could be to like River or Coinbase or Block, some like institution. It could be either of those. That's generally how it works. So I definitely don't think it's like super straightforward. Like obviously it's great or it's horrible. It's a really good discussion and debate. I myself went down the vault rabbit hole a long time ago and was an enthusiastic supporter. I'm a little more skeptical now, because of some of the concerns I just mentioned that others are raising. But I have a bit more homework to do myself. Before I have a conviction on like what I think about vaults.
And you mentioned it's a consensus change, which just to flag, that's the big important ones to be.
Yeah. Well, again, Liana is an example of a product that implemented it without a consensus change.
Right.
So they proved it can be done. They did not. I don't think they've gotten much adoption. There are caveats to it. Covenants would improve that. So vault covenant based vault proponents will be like, well, they failed because they didn't have covenants, and covenants improves the user experience a lot in simplicity. Mm-hmm. That could be true. But
even in the case where if you got covenants through, would you still have to add a completely separate opcode? Like, or is this something that more generalizably could be done if you got one blanket covenant?
I think out of the 8 or 10 different covenant proposals, I think most, if not all,
would cover this.
Would cover this. In fact, I mean, one of the proposals is literally called Op Vault. So that's an example of a consensus change and a covenant change that is very application specific.
Yeah.
Like it's intentional that it's going to do vaults and sort of vaults only and doesn't want to open up all these other can of worms.
Yeah.
So that's an entire philosophy in and of itself. Like when we do consensus changes are so hard.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's hard to do. So, you know, one train of thought is like, well, let's do application specific. We can confine it. We can reduce the risk exposure.
Right.
And because we know this particular application or use case is really valuable. So let's narrow it down. Another train of thought is like that, you know, we need more general tools for developers. Yeah. Let a thousand flowers bloom.
Yeah.
Let's give them general tools and see what happens. And, you know, there's, I think, pretty obvious pros and cons to each of those approaches. We don't want a Bitcoin where there's a thousand specific opcodes added, application-specific opcodes. That's like
more abstract.
That's a total nightmare to maintain. And then understanding the interactions between all those would get really complicated. So we don't want that. So it seems like we would only want a few more changes at most that are application-specific or like a more general change.
I mean, without going super deep in this, and perhaps we'll do a longer dive in, but, you know, my relatively uneducated position on Vault specifically is, you know, if you have to have watchtowers in the first place, it sounds like this is probably going to be used by companies. And if it's already going to be used by companies, then there's a decent amount of trust. You're already kind of trusting companies like Coinbase and River to do it. I mean, I'm not saying there's not cases where individual holders would do it, and that's great. But to me, given how hard it is to get any consensus change through, the payoff needs to be like very obvious and very big. Something that potentially allows Bitcoin to be used custodially by 8 billion people, that to me is like, okay, that's a prize worth fighting for, taking risk for. But something where it's like, yeah, it kind of gives me some advantage that River doesn't, but like, does it really give me that much? I don't know. It sounds less exciting.
I tend to agree, but maybe in a, you know, if I do a deep dive or any of us do, we can spend a more substantial amount of time on it in the future.
Cool. Well, Steve said he's going to do the homework. So
thanks, Steve. Yeah.
So thank you, Steve, for all the homework. We look forward to being educated on this in a future episode.
And DK is going to build us a Bitcoin powered March Madness bracket for next
week.
So thank you, DK.
On it. Thank you. Okay. Well, you will hear it here next week when we get together again. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, everyone.
Until next time.
All right. Bye bye.